first case for oral argument today on the northern panel's schedule is Geiger v. Sunrise Hospital and Medical Center, case number 58972. Counsel, ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Are you arguing, Mr. Sharp?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
Your Honor, Matthew Sharp with me, Gerald Goodhock and Carol Hay on behalf of Evan Geiger and his parents, Matt and Gail Geiger. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal.
Okay.
So, I think in this case, a new trial is required pursuant to NRCP 59A1 for two primary reasons. First, there was an irregularity in the proceedings, and secondly, there was an abuse of discretion by the judge that deprived Evan Geiger of his fair trial. And the basis for our request are, you know, 5 or 6 points, really. It begins with the jury selection process. The fact is that the juror's relationship, Juror Bulicki's relationship with the Sunrise attorney team was not disclosed. And as a result, Evan Geiger, through his attorneys, was deprived of the ability to engage in a meaningful voir dire to determine if there was a for-cause basis for termination. The trial judge abused his discretion by not simply, the easy choice to cure the irregularity was to simply dismiss Juror Bulicki from the panel. There would have been absolutely no prejudice to Sunrise. It would have cured the stain on the process, and the trial could have gone forward. And that was at two separate points. There was initially before the jury was sworn in, and the next day after the jury had been sworn in, we had a hearing in which the financial relationship that Bulicki, Juror Bulicki had with the Sunrise Defense Medical Team in the form of the paralegal who was in charge of the case, her husband and the juror had an ongoing financial relationship. At that time, we moved to excuse Juror Bulicki. There were four alternates, and there was simply no reason why the judge could not have excused Juror Bulicki and proceeded forward. And I think what happened as a result of the irregularities that occurred during the jury selection and permeated the proceedings, resulted in the defense verdict, and I think the irregularities and unjustness of the trial was exacerbated by Mr. Prangle's closing argument, but the primary basis for the new trial is what occurred during the jury selection. And I would just point to the law. There are 3 points to consider. First, we know under our U.S. Constitution and our state constitution, the right to trial by jury shall not be violated. And we know from our decisions from both the U.S. Supreme Court and this court that the essence of a fair trial depends on fair and impartial jurors. We know that the Nevada legislature has deemed the voir dire process to be so important they've provided a party with the substantive right to conduct voir dire. This court, in the Whitlock case, confirmed that and also adopted a common law right for voir dire.
Did the process selected by the judge for conducting voir dire violate Chapter 16?
Well, in my view, it did. I don't think that's not the sole basis for what we're proceeding forward with for granting a new trial, because I think in fairness to the trial judge under Whitlock, there is a certain amount of discretion. But what this court can't ignore is the fact of how that selection process affected the proceedings. And I'm
trying to gain an understanding of the process the way I read it in the appendix. The way I understand the process described by the trial judge, you get everybody in the box, and you start examining the first juror. if the first juror is unacceptable to, say, the plaintiff, they exercise their preemptory challenge.
Can I interrupt, Your Honor? That's not exactly the way I recall the proceeding was. You individually were guided each juror for cause. Then the plan, Evan Geiger would pass, followed by the defendants. Then it came to a point where we started to exercise preemptories. And unlike the Arizona method, where you have the entire box filled and you know who your potential jurors are going to be, if I were to, for example, strike Justice Hardesty, then Justice Perry sitting in the audience, he's brought in as the next juror to fill that your seat. That's the problem that was created and why the error was so significant, because what happened was we exercised a preemptory, just Juror Belicki assumed the seat, and the only basis we could at that point protect Evan Geiger's interest was for cause voir dire, which is why it was so important that we be given the information relating to both the fact that the Sunrise Defense Medical Team had a relationship with Juror Belicki and the financial nature of that relationship, because otherwise we couldn't do our voir dire, and that's really the substantive right that was violated.
Well, what I'm trying to understand is this process, because I don't recall seeing this in the Second District. I don't recall seeing this, frankly, in any trial I've seen come out of the Eighth District, but the process, as I understand it, is that the jurors called into the box, you may exercise a preempt. That individual is then replaced, examined further, and the defense or you may exercise a preempt. And everybody keeps exercising a preempt. When they're all gone, then you fill up the rest of the box and nobody has any preempts left? Is that how this thing works?
That is exactly how it ended up.
So it's entirely possible that all eight preempts could be exercised against eight jurors who sat in juror number one, and the remaining jurors could be called into the box and all the preempts are gone.
Not literally seat number one, but that is exactly what happened.
Could be literally seat
number one. And in our case, it literally did happen that way, which is why Juror Belicki assumed, we'll say spot number one. I don't remember what her juror number was.
So my question again is, NRS 160306 extends to the parties the right to voir dire, and it must not be unreasonably restricted. Did that process result in an unreasonable restriction against your voir dire, against the jurors who would come in and fill juror 2 through 8?
I think it did, Your Honor. And in addition to that, the subsequent events that unfolded with Juror Belicki further infringed upon Evan Geiger's right to have his attorneys conduct a meaningful voir dire.
Is it at that point that it becomes unreasonable and you make that objection because you did not make an objection to the process initially?
And I agree with you. And that's, in our view, the point in which the substantive rights to Evan Geiger deprived him of a fair trial. I'll cite you, I don't do this very often, but I'll cite you right to the record, 567 and 568 of the joint appendix. And Leo Gallus, who was one of our co-counsel at the time, he expressed in his experience, which I point out is substantial, that he never seen anything like this. And I raise that not because Leo Gallus provides legal authority, but to point to you, to the questions that were just asked, that the deprivation that occurred, the statute, the common law and the Constitution provides Evan Geiger the ability to engage in meaningful voir dire. That didn't happen. And it was a two-step process. It didn't happen, one, because of the process the judge selected, and secondly, the events that unfolded and the failure to disclose the relationship with Juror Belicki. Justice Chair, I'm not sure if you had a question. Noticed you moving back and forth.
Well, just that I think that you need to put in the record exactly when it occurred that you learned about her relationship with Sunrise.
Well,
exactly when did it occur?
Okay, so the process was the first day after we passed for cause, Sunrise then disclosed a general relationship with Juror Bielecki. We moved to disqualify Juror Bielecki at that point. The trial judge denied it. The next day, before opening statements, we asked for reconsideration of our motion and insisted upon a hearing. At that hearing, the paralegal for the Sunrise defense team was sworn, and at that point, the financial relationship was disclosed. So it was a two-step process. Once we knew the financial relationship, we again moved to disqualify Juror Bielecki. There would have been absolutely no prejudice to either side. We had four alternates. And it would have been an easy solution. Instead, it didn't happen. And effectively, Evan Geiger's the one who gets penalized. He didn't do anything wrong, yet effectively, he was penalized. And I would just point, you know, I was looking at this, you know, sometimes we get carried away in the brief and we don't always step back and look at the statutes, but I was, this weekend I was looking at NRS 16050, and one subpart E for issues for cause. It says if a juror has an interest in the action other than as a citizen of the community. And I would suggest when you have you call it direct, call it indirect, but when a juror is seated and that juror has a financial relationship with any team, whether it's the defense or plaintiff team, that's not consistent with a fair and impartial jury. And that's what the trial judge allowed to happen. And that's why, in our opinion, Rule 59A1 requires a new trial. And with that, unless there are other questions that the panel has, I'll reserve the rest for rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Mike Kleinberg on behalf of Sunrise Hospital. I think it's interesting in Mr. Sharp's comments. At no point did he suggest that there was a lack of evidence introduced by the defense to support this verdict. That's very important for this court's inquiry, given that there was no objection made to the process of jury selection, timely, and as it relates to the attorney misconduct allegations, no objection was made at trial. So before this court can order a new trial based on that, number one, we have to find that there was a fundamental error. And the point with that is that there's no other explanation for this verdict. For example, in the Elias case, where it was an admitted liability case and the defense was able to get a complete not guilty, even though there were uncontested medical bills. And this panel, I believe, was the Elias panel, in which you identified that as that rare case where, because the evidence is so overwhelming, that there's just simply nothing other than the misconduct or the error that explains this result. Plaintiff doesn't even argue that. In this case, there is evidence introduced by the defense supporting that the nurses and respiratory therapists, as well as the doctors, fully complied with the standard of care. This is not a case where there was no evidence. There was. But now turning to the jury selection question.
Well, on that point, there seems to be, and the judge analyzes this, some concern about Juror Bielecki's involvement in the deliberation process and the utilization of her expertise in assessing the extent to which oxygen was deprived or not. Can you give us your view about that?
Sure. There were two issues. You may recall that after the verdict, the plaintiff interviewed Bielecki, and we had this hearsay affidavit that Judge Bixler, I believe, correctly ruled it was an improper attempt to impeach the verdict. Mm-hmm. But the point that was made in that affidavit was that Ms. Bielecki said words to the effect of that she believed that the carbon dioxide levels over the days were not consistent with a child who was deteriorating, as was plaintiff's claim. And then secondly, making a comment about Mr. Geiger's failure to basically call for help between 10 p.m. on the 24th and 4 a.m. on the 25th. And the suggestion was made that Dr. Bernicke was using her knowledge as a veterinarian to answer those questions. And that's not true. All you have to do is read my closing argument, and you'll see that every day there's one particular arterial blood gas that was drawn on the 23rd that was a particular focus of the case. But there were blood gases measuring the carbon dioxide every day in this critical period of time. And one of the arguments that we made is that Evan's condition wasn't getting worse, because if it was, these carbon dioxide levels would be going down or going up. And they were. So I believe what Julie Bernicke was saying is that she accepted the evidence introduced by the defense to the point that Evan's condition was not getting worse. As to the question of Mr. Geiger's response, plaintiffs have suggested that she introduced a comparative negligence issue. That's not true. There was a conflict in the evidence as to when Evan's condition began to deteriorate. Mr. Geiger at trial testified that it was about 10 p.m. on the 24th. We introduced evidence from the nurses and Dr. Lipscomb that Evan's condition from 10 o'clock up to basically 4 o'clock in the morning on the 25th was actually stable. In fact, Mr. Geiger prepared some notes contemporaneous with these events. And in his notes, he identified that it was actually 4 o'clock in the morning that Evan's condition suddenly changed. So the point was not to cast blame on Mr. Geiger. That was never the intent. It was rather to help the jury understand when did Evan's condition change. Because a critical issue for the doctors was when did the standard of care require that he be intubated. Plaintiff's claim was that because his condition began to deteriorate around 10, he had to be intubated sooner. We took the position, as well as Mr. Cotton, on behalf of the doctors, that Dr. Lipscomb in particular, that the standard of care didn't require it because Evan's condition remained stable. So I believe that what Dr. Bernicke is identifying is that because Mr. Geiger, who along with his wife were excellent caregivers for this child, he would have reacted sooner if his condition was really changing. Wasn't blaming him, but using it to corroborate the notion that Evan's condition was not getting worse. So I'm not sure if that answered your question, but then switching to the jury section, because I do think this is an important point. I believe what was described as slightly inaccurate. The way jury selection was done was that we got 12 people in the box. It would be 8 potential jurors and the 4 alternates before any parameters were used. So what we did is, as jurors came in, we would question them and pass them for cause. And we did that until we had 12 people in the box. And it was at that point that we began to exercise the peremptories. And so, they went back and forth, and plaintiff exercised their last peremptory on juror number 7, who was the chair that was about to be assumed by Dr. Bernicke. So it was after it had used all of the peremptory challenges that Dr. Bernicke then comes into the box, and this issue with Mary Klaus then happens, where I, for the first time, don't have any connection at all with Dr. Bernicke. I believe Mr. Sharp's questioning of Dr. Bernicke lasted about 5 minutes. It was relatively brief. And during that time, a note had been passed to me, saying, Lori, my paralegal, knows Dr. Bernicke. She had been to her house some period of time before and that she was a veterinarian. Mr. Sharp finishes his questioning, passes for cause, and I get up, and my very first question to Dr. Bernicke is, do you know Larry Klaus? Because I now have the information. So as soon as I had it, then my next opportunity to speak, I disclosed it. But I believe that it's important because the process was not simply, let's get somebody in chair one and potentially we'll use all the characters with that one person.
Is this a case where the alternates knew that there were alternates during the presentation of the evidence? Because I know some judges don't tell them until they go to deliberate, oh, by the way, you 4 jurors are alternates. And you're not going to deliberate with the other eight.
I confess, Justice Chair, I don't know the answer. I don't recall. But Juror Galicki turned out to be our, I believe it was juror number seven, so she was the penultimate main juror, if that matters.
I know when they do that, it doesn't really matter what number it is of the 12. In other words, juror number six could be an alternate, juror number four could be an alternate.
Well, the way it did work is 9 through 12 were the alternates. Right. I just don't remember if we advised the jury of that fact beforehand.
So why did you hold on to it after they raised the objection so that it would be completely clean? In other words,
because she was a qualified juror. This was a very complicated medical malpractice case. I wanted smart people on the jury. Dr. Galicki was a smart woman. And I don't believe the question is, could we have done something else that would have been harmless? I think the question needs to be, is what was done, did it deprive plaintiff of a fair trial? And it didn't. It didn't. I mean, Juror Galicki, if you read Judge Bixler's memorandum of finding after the post-trial motion, he was emphatic that after it became known that there was this connection, Judge Bixler actually deviated from his practice. He, again, after I finished my voir dire, Judge Galicki on his own conducted additional voir dire.
Judge Bixler.
I'm sorry, what was
Judge, you said Galicki.
I'm sorry. Judge Bixler conducted additional voir dire of Dr. Galicki, basically asking her, does it matter at all? And Judge Galicki, without hesitation, without pause, said it matters not to me. And Judge Bixler makes a big point of that in that order after the post-trial motion. It just didn't matter to her. So the two questions on jury selection is, did we somehow limit inappropriately the voir dire that was allowed by plaintiff? And then secondly, is Juror Galicki, was she united in business?
Perhaps the better question is whether or not the voir dire process unfairly limited the party's ability to use preempts. That's my question.
Because
the only explanation offered by the judge in his order is that, in effect, each party was treated the same with respect to how preempts would operate. And that wasn't an overwhelmingly comforting explanation, to me at least, just because each of you would run out and there'd be no more opportunity for preempts doesn't necessarily provide an adequate remedy for what the voir dire process might produce.
Any system that contemplates peremptory challenges, one of the risks with that system is that at some point you're going to run out. At some point you're going to run out of preemptions.
I'm not sure I agree. Generally speaking, in the trials I'm familiar with, you know who your full panel is before you start exercising your preempts.
Some judges do it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I confess I have had judges in the 8th District who have done it that way. I've had others who haven't. Mm-hmm. I have tried cases.
Have you seen this system used, Mr. Pringle, in the 8th District before?
I'm not certain. I know I have had cases. I'm not sure if it was in the 8th District,
mm-hmm.
where the process essentially worked this way. Whenever you exercise a challenge, a brand new body comes into the box.
Yeah.
But my point in terms of the fairness...
But at that point, the only examination of the juror is going to be for cause determinations, not to exercise a preempt.
And the
problem that presents is that if the individual who comes in with the box, for whatever reason, is less acceptable to you, for example, than the person that you just booted, you've lost the boot.
Absolutely, Judge, and that is one of the risks of this process.
Sure.
There are many times when I have people on the jury that I would just soon not have on the jury.
Mm-hmm.
But because I have not established a four-cause challenge, I'm stuck with them. I mean, that's the nature of the beast. So was it fair? I mean, it did apply equally to both sides. There was no objection to the process before the fact. And in no way, shape, or form is there anything that Dr. Galicki said that would constitute a four-cause challenge.
Could you clarify one part of that point? I tried to look at it before we came out here, and I didn't have time. The testimony offered by Dr. Bilecki, or excuse me, by your paralegal, when was the last referral by her veterinarian husband?
She couldn't recall. She was asked that question.
She didn't know the time period from when Dr. Bilecki had received the last referral?
The question was asked by Judge Bixler of Mary Klaus, and she had no knowledge. So we don't know that.
That question was asked of Judge Bilecki as well, and I thought there was an answer to it.
You may recall that when this issue came to light, plaintiff had passed for cause. I had questioned it of Rodney Bilecki, and then Judge Bixler did. That question was not asked.
Okay.
When the financial component to it became fleshed out the next day, when Mary Klaus testified, Judge Bixler gave plaintiff the option to either do an additional voir dire of Bilecki themselves, or to have the court do it. So this type of detail could be fleshed out. They chose not to do it.
Okay.
So
neither the court nor plaintiff examined juror Bilecki further after the Klaus testimony.
I believe that's correct.
I realize your best your memory.
My recollection is that the last time Bilecki herself was asked questions was on that same day that she was initially questioned. The following day, which I believe was March 2nd, is when Mary Klaus, by that point the jury had been sworn, and then Mary gave her testimony, and again this issue was revisited, and Judge Bixler was satisfied that for the four-cause challenge that Dr. Bilecki had given the appropriate responses without any equivocation, that he was satisfied that she did not have a bias toward any part. So then the remaining challenge that leaves is whether jury Bilecki was united in business with a party.
Just one other point of clarification. Was the jury sworn before Klaus testified?
That's my recollection, Judge. We started jury selection on February 28th. We completed it on the 1st, and it was on the 1st that this issue with Dr. Bilecki came up. I don't recall if the jury was sworn that day or the morning of the 2nd, but then after the jury was sworn, it was either Mr. Sharp or Mr. Gillock re-raised this issue with Judge Bixler, and it was at that point, I don't recall whose suggestion it was, but it was suggested that Mary give testimony, and it was at that point that she was questioned. And what Mary's testimony helped establish is that the sole connection that there was that Mary's husband, Mark, who's also a veterinarian, had referred cases, and we don't know how many, we don't know how recently, and that when such a referral would happen, Ms. Klaus' husband would not pay for it, but rather the patients would still pay for it. And that was it. So in terms of the definition of united in business, and actually the only case that we were able to find that helps define that is the Sherman versus Southern Pacific case going all the way back to 1910, where it talks about, or it defines, united in business as being that the juror might be interested, biased, influenced, or embarrassed in his verdict. So that's the inquiry. And there's not one case that plaintiff cited, there's not one case that we could find to suggest that the tenuous connection that we have here was sufficient to rise to that level of being united in business, especially when their unequivocal testimony or questioning was that it mattered not to them. There are a number of cases that were cited by plaintiff where there was one with the railroad case where the juror had shipped goods on the railroad line, but when that juror was further questioned, the juror said, I'm not sure I can be fair, and this really might not be a good case for me to be on. So every case that is cited is very much distinguishable from the circumstances we have here, because Juror Bilecki, to Judge Bixler's satisfaction, said that it mattered not to her. And it really didn't. I mean, there's no indication at all that Juror Bilecki did anything wrong in her deliberations. It was a unanimous verdict of eight, so even if we take juror Balicki out of it, it's still a defense verdict, and there's no indication, no evidence at all, that juror Balicki tried to unduly influence the other juror. So I believe, even if you believe that she should have been knocked off, it's a harmless error because it was a unanimous verdict. But number two, and kind of getting back to the point, is you have to show that it likely caused prejudice to the plaintiff. Again, this was a case that was evenly balanced in terms of whether the standard of care required Evan to be intubated sooner. That was really what the question in the case was. And then on a causation basis, whether an earlier intubation would have mattered because of the location where the bleed happened and the cause of his brain injury. But the jury never got to causation, but on the standard of care as it relates to my nurses, there were three things that were claimed that my staff did wrong. Number one, that they didn't tell Dr. Beruga about the December 23rd blood gas. Dr. Beruga testified he got the blood gas. We had nurses charting in the record Dr. Aware of the blood gas. And third, we had a nurse McFarland, I believe it was, who justified, I told Dr. Beruga of the blood gas. So that was issue one. Issue two had to do with the breathing treatments. Were there sufficient breathing treatments done with the albuterol and the Lyrase epi? And Dr. Lipscomb, who is the doctor who ordered both of those breathing treatments, testified that when she came in on the morning of the 24th, one of the things she would have looked at was, were my breathing treatments done? Or were my errors being carried out the prior day? And she said, unequivocally, they were. And then the third point is whether or not the nurses and respiratory therapists were keeping the doctors properly informed of Evan's condition. And both Dr. Beruga and Dr. Lipscomb, without any equivocation, said they did that. This was not a case where there was unknown information that, had it been known, would have caused a difference in treatment. This was a case where, because of the severity of Evan's condition, the doctors wanted to avoid intubating as long as they possibly could. Because intubating a child like Evan necessarily means he's going to get pneumonia. Just because he's immunocompromised, you're going to introduce this foreign body into his throat. So the doctors were motivated to not intubate. And they were happy that from the 22nd to the 24th, Evan seemed to be getting better. But what happened in the early morning hours of the 25th is that one of these lesions that Evan had in his throat ruptured, and it began to bleed. And that's what caused this problem. So when Dr. Lipscomb was called to the bedside in the early morning hours of the 25th, by my nurse, she says, you know, I can no longer delay intubating. That was a conscious decision that she made with full knowledge. It wasn't based on a lack of communication by my nurses. It had nothing to do with the breathing treatments. And it had nothing to do, quite honestly, with the blood gas on December 23rd. It was her decision at that point to intubate. So there was, you know, plenty of evidence in this record that supports the jury's verdict. And there's nothing that happened in jury selection that I believe materially impacts that. Again, you know, Dr. Balicki was one of eight. And in a matter of, I believe it's about 3 hours, they returned a verdict for the defense. And I believe this is in one of the affidavits, that the testimony from the jury was that they got to unanimous on the second vote. The first vote was 6-2 for the defense. And after a brief period of discussion, they voted again, and it was 8-0. And again, there's no information in the record at all to support the conclusion that Dr. Balicki, motivated by whatever, is somehow that she wasn't honest with the court or counsel, and that she really had an axe to grind, that she somehow twisted the arms of the jury. That's simply absent from this record. So even if Your Honor believes that there was a better way for this to be done. But in bear mind, you know, the law of this court is that the trial judge has broad discretion in the way they can choose to conduct voir dire. And here in the circumstance where the judge announces truths beforehand, here's how we're going to do it, and no one objects to it, to me, fairness was required, you know, given to the plaintiffs, fairness was given to the defense, it was an equal standard for both of us. So I believe that for those reasons, as well as the reasons in my briefs, the verdict of the trial court should be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Franco.
just want to make a couple points, and then I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Gillock. The first point I want to make is this whole issue that we would have had to prove a different result. The standard is set forth in Whitlock versus Salmon. In Whitlock, this court didn't say, oh, geez, could the plaintiff have won? The fact is the meaningful right to conduct voir dire was deprived in Whitlock, and as a result, a new trial was ordered. And that's the result that should be provided in this case. Secondly, there was evidence, and I think Mr. Prang acknowledged there was evidence to substantiate a plaintiff's verdict. The trial judge indicated 7 times out of 10, this goes to the plaintiff. We identified in the record at page 10 of our reply brief Dr. Neath, our expert's testimony. There was evidence. The second point I would make is just procedurally, because the problem began with the selection process. And so what occurred is once Juror Bielicki was placed in the box, we could only get rid for cause. We weren't given the information necessary until she had been passed for cause. This whole issue about the financial relationship never came out until the jurors had been sworn in. The only remedy available to the judge was to excuse her, and there were, as I said, 4 alternates. This was a question simply of fairness. And in the event, what really happened is every guy who gets penalized, and Sunrise gets rewarded for not telling material facts. It was clearly material. Now, the nature of the relationship...
Well, are you claiming that they had all of this information, they had this information significantly before the paralegal was introduced in court?
Well, they obviously had the information. I mean, they knew. Now, Lynn, I'm not going to get in Mr. Prang.
What information? You're saying clearly they had the information. What information?
They knew there was a relationship between Ms. Klaus and Juror Bielicki. When I was questioning her, I think that's what Mr. Prang had just said, before I had passed for cause. My problem is once passed for cause and find out that information, it's too late. The way to preserve the interests of the party is to simply excuse this juror. It's not a situation in what the trial judge got focused on.
But the trial judge came back to follow up on the cause, determination, correct?
But what the trial judge ignored was the standard in Weber, which isn't a subjective standard. It's looking at the issues as a whole. And I would submit, looking at the issues as a whole, you have to look at both her responses, the subsequent financial disclosure, the nature of the jury relationship. We could not protect our interests like the lawyer could in Jitman. We could only get excused for cause. Given all of those circumstances, the record on a whole justified getting rid of her for cause. The other result is the permeation of irregularity of the proceedings.
But the for cause is all you had left at that point. All of your preempts had been exercised. Okay, and my understanding is there wasn't an issue until she had been seated after all your preempts were exercised, right?
That's correct, and we didn't discover the problem of Juror Bielicki until after we had passed for cause. That's the whole harm, that's the beginning of the harm to us, was that we didn't have the ability to conduct a meaningful voir dire of Juror Bielicki. That's a violation of the statute and of Whitlock, the remedy of which is a new trial.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sharp. Mr. Cranwell, you ran over about a minute. Mr. Gillock, you have a minute.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Honorable Justices. I just want to take a brief second to outline the exact way this happened, because that seems to be critical here. The afternoon session of the Court, the paralegal goes to and sits at counsel table. She rises up and they introduce her to the jury panel. Juror Bielicki is sitting on the first row in the audience. Nothing is said to indicate a relationship. We used all of our preempts. We had nothing left. We preempted a juror. Juror Bielicki takes the stand because, why? Because on her jury affidavit, which is attached to the record, she says occupation is blind. And absolutely no indication she's a veterinarian or a doctor or any medical training. So we question her for cause. It comes out that she's a veterinarian. They don't reveal the fact that they know who she is. They then indicate, after we pass for cause, counsel indicates to them that there's truly no paralegal. Nothing said about the relationship between two veterinarians. So they, at that point in time, they don't reveal to us that there's a financial relationship or that she's a veterinarian who works on her husband's patients in his clinic. She's their surgeon. It's not revealed. The only thing is, well, as a matter of fact, you've been in their house. It wasn't revealed that it was a business Christmas party in their house. We moved to strike for cause. The judge denies it. The jury's impaneled. The next morning, we filed a written motion striking for cause. The judge allows us to put the person on the stand, reminding this court, at that point, there is no information about this financial connection. At this point, nobody still knows that Drew Bilecki works for the paralegal who is sitting at counsel table. We put on the stand, we find out that she is a surgeon and that she does surgery on Dr. Kloss's patients. At that time, we move once again to strike her for cause. Remembering the process is we didn't argue with the process because I don't think anybody who's tried cases in this jurisdiction would ever anticipate a system whereby you would run out of peremptory challenges before you have all the people in the box. Every other case, we've had the entire panel there. In closing, I'd just like to say this court is Nevada's highest and most trusted and respected tribunal. You're the guardian not just of procedure, but you're the guardian of justice. And in this case, Evan Geiger was denied his justice. And that's why we're here before this court. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Sharp, Mr. Dove, for your arguments here today and your briefs in this matter. The case will stand submitted.